Good evening and welcome to the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Julian Chang and I am tonight's moderator for the program entitled Unfriendly Fire, a look at the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy by Dr. Aaron Belkin. Tonight's program is sponsored by the LGBT member-led forum of the Commonwealth Club. And now, let me introduce our guest, Dr. Aaron Belkin. Aaron is an associate professor of political science at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has published extensively in the areas of civil-military relations, social science methodology, and sexuality in the armed forces. His recent studies include analysis of aerial coercion and strategic bombing, the conceptualization of coup risk, and the relationship between coup-proofing strategies and international conflict. His publications have appeared in International Security, Armed Forces and Society, the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and he has spoken at the U.S. Army War College and elsewhere. He has made numerous presentations on gays in the military at the Army War College, the National Defense University, the Naval Postgraduate School, and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I have to also disclose at this point that I am a governing board member of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, otherwise known as SLDN. It is our honor and privilege to work on a national level with Dr. Belkin. He is a committed and very effective force for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And personally, Aaron, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
It is a sincere honor to be here tonight. Thank you so much, Julian, for the kind words, and to Bob Dockendorf, and to Stephen Sewer, to Gloria Duffy, and to all the people here at the club who make this such a special space. I'd also like to acknowledge that there is a very beloved and honored guest in the audience tonight. Johnny Simons is a filmmaker, an award-winning filmmaker, whose work has won prizes at Sundance and elsewhere, and who is just now releasing a film on Don't Ask, Don't Tell called Ask Not, which will be broadcast on PBS with over a million viewers. So, Johnny, thank you so much for coming tonight. It's really, really a pleasure to be in the same space with you. I want to organize my remarks tonight in terms of three different points. And I want to start with a little bit of a meditation on why I think that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is such an important topic for all of us to worry about whether or not we're gay and whether or not we care about the military. It is absolutely the case that Don't Ask, Don't Tell hurts the military and causes us to lose valuable talent, Arabic linguists, to waste money firing people who shouldn't be fired. As Nathaniel Frank explains in his new book, Unfriendly Fire, the policy makes it harder for units to form bonds of trust. The policy hurts the military. That's not the reason we should care about it. It is also the case that the policy is responsible for a great deal of violence, both inside the military and outside the military. Anyone who has worked in this movement for a while knows of people who have died from suicide after having been fired, lost their livelihood that they love. Other people know of people, women, who have been sexually assaulted and who were not able to report the abuse because they were afraid of being labeled as a lesbian and hence thrown out of the military. Other people are aware of a study that the Palm Center published that shows that in Canada, violence against women went down by more than 40% after their gay ban was lifted. It is certainly the case that this policy is responsible for a lot of violence. And yet that is not the main reason why we should be concerned about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I want to make the claim that the principal problem with Don't Ask, Don't Tell doesn't really have anything to do with the military or with gay people, but it's really a question of what it means to be an American and what American citizenship means for all of us, gay and straight. My understanding of freedom is that part of what it means to be free is to be able to identify as you wish. If you want to be a woman, you can be a woman. If you want to be a Jew, you can be a Jew. If you want to be a Democrat, you can be a Democrat. If you want to be a Republican, you can even be that. Part of what it means in this country is you get to identify as the person you wish to be, and the state doesn't have the right to seize that identification from you. Very sadly, however, and not just with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but it's the case with any discriminatory project, any project of disenfranchisement, the first move that the discriminators have to make, always, is to define who's in and who's out, because otherwise judges, administrators, regulators, targets of discrimination, everyone else, has no way of knowing who's on the right side of the line and who's on the wrong side of the line. And that's the reason why one of the first orders of business under the Nazis was to put in place a formal definition of who's going to be counted as a Jew. All discriminatory projects have to do that. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell is no different. There is now a federal law, congressional statute on the books, that defines who a gay person is. Now, all of us who study Don't Ask, Don't Tell have a lot of problems with the definition that Congress has enacted, and some people would even argue that there's no possible coherent way of defining a gay person that lines up perfectly with every single person in every single way. So the problem is not that the definition on the federal books is incoherent, even though it is, and we can get into details and questions and answers if you want. The problem is that there is a definition at all. The state should not be in the business of telling people you are gay or you are straight. And if you look at transcripts of administrative discharge hearings, they look a lot like Salem witch trials from more than 300 years ago, where women would say, "I'm not a witch." And the court would say, "You are a witch." And the woman would bring evidence, "I'm not a witch," and back and forth over the person's identity. That's just what it looks like today in the military justice system. That is a profoundly dangerous moment. Eve Sedgwick, a queer theorist, says that to take away someone's right to name their own identity is a consequential seizure. And Janet Halley, a professor at Harvard Law School, wrote a book in which she argued, successfully, I believe, that if the standard at the heart of Don't Ask, Don't Tell were amplified to other laws and other government institutions, that would be a very dangerous precedent indeed. Indeed, it would be the first step on the road to fascism. So, yes, Don't Ask, Don't Tell hurts the military, and yes, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is responsible for an awful lot of violence, and there would be, it's not that violence would disappear if Don't Ask, Don't Tell were repealed, but it would go down. That's what the research shows. But the real problem with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the biggest problem, is the corruption of American citizenship and democracy and freedom. That's why I care about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that's why I've been working on it every day, pretty much all day for 10 years. I'd like to, in the second part of my remarks, talk a little bit about the costs of the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I spent a few minutes talking about why it's so important to work on this policy. But now I want to talk about what it costs to fight Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I would specifically like to hone in for a minute on a conference that I attended at UC Santa Barbara a few weeks ago. It was a conference for gay and lesbian, queer, bisexual, transgender questioning students. And a student who I believe was gay, probably 18 or 19 years old, sitting at a table, one of the conference sessions, was talking about his feelings about the military. And he said he would like to serve in the military. And every time he sees a commercial about the military on television, he cries because he thinks the military is a beautiful organization and a beautiful institution. And I, not in a judgmental way, but and I didn't even communicate this to him, but I want to claim that that student has become militarized in a way that is dangerous for the deliberative process in the United States. And so in the second part of my remarks, I would like to talk a little bit about what militarization means and what it is. And then in the third and final part of my talk, I'm going to link the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell with the militarization of American culture. So what is militarization and why is it important? Militarization is, there's a debate in the literature about what militarization is, but it is basically the moment at which something depends for its value on glorified ideas about either the military as an organization or the use of military force in general. And I know that's kind of a vague, kind of abstract concept, but I'm going to kind of specify what I mean over the next few minutes. But the most important thing to note about militarization is that it has to do with things that derive their value from their association with military ideas. Militarization, just continuing to describe it before illustrating it and explaining its implications. Militarization is subtle. As I argued a second ago, students can be militarized. Cars can be militarized when they're designed to look like military vehicles, like Hummers. Clothing can be militarized when children are encouraged to dress or choose to dress in clothes that look like military camouflage. So militarization and militarism are not just about tanks and military budgets and debates on the floors of Congress, although all those things can be militarized as well. But militarization can be very, very subtle. Another piece of militarization is the idea of soldiering as the epitome of Americanness, that to prove your patriotism and your Americanness, the best way to do that is to become a member of the armed forces and to serve our military organization. In other words, teaching is not the epitome of citizenship. Being a rape crisis counselor is not the epitome of citizenship. Being a policeman or woman is not the epitome of citizenship. But the idea that the most American, the most patriotic among us are our service members, that is a fundamental piece of militarism and militarization. And then a last piece of what militarization is, and then I'll give some more examples and talk about its implications. But a last piece is the idea that everything I've said for the last few minutes is unproblematic. So it's the moment, for example, when a parent takes their child to an air show and wonders in the beauty and the glory of the planes, and they are beautiful and glorious, let's not kid ourselves, but doesn't also ask questions, what are these airplanes for? What are they doing? Who is suffering as a result of these airplanes? Just to give a few examples, specify what I mean by militarization, I often think of the 2004 Democratic National Convention when John Kerry stepped in front of the podium in front of tens of thousands of audience members and tens of millions of listeners and viewers, and the first thing he did was saluted and said, reporting for duty. So there are lofty moments that get militarized, but there are also incredibly micro moments that get militarized as well. I think, for example, of a meeting that I had 2 weeks ago at University of California, Santa Barbara. I was placed reluctantly by my dean on a committee to advise the campus ROTC program. And the colonel who's given faculty status by the University of California, who's in charge of ROTC, introduced the meeting by speaking for 30 minutes about how pleased he was to have convened this committee of faculty members because now the faculty members could serve as ROTC's advocate on campus. And I sat there quietly for about an hour, and I made a little list of 13 different ways in which ROTC had either successfully or tried to militarize UC Santa Barbara. For example, seeking permission to... The Pentagon is listening. For example, seeking permission for ROTC cadets to rappel down buildings, seeking permission to land a helicopter on campus, seeking permission to paint the ROTC campus building the colors of the Army, black with a gold stripe. And I listened to all this for an hour, and after an hour I finally spoke up and I said, I just want to be clear, I'm glad to provide advice, but in no way will I serve as an advocate or an activist for ROTC on campus. Well, that moment was immediately redeployed into a pro-militarist articulation, and without missing a beat or a breath, the colonel in charge of ROTC said, that's wonderful, because when departments have questions about ROTC on campus, you can go answer those questions as a critic of ROTC, and you'll have more credibility. And I said, but don't you understand how that would militarize me? At which point you can imagine what my role in the meeting became. So militarization can take many forms. I want to argue that it's incredibly dangerous to have a society as militarized as our society is, that militarization is so subtle but is so overdetermined that it has become hidden in plain sight, and that that's a dangerous thing. Not that we should walk around criticizing the military all the time. That's not the point. But the point is that even the military benefits when civilian control is robust and when the citizenship is engaged in military matters. For example, before the war in Afghanistan, we did not even have a debate in this country about whether war was the appropriate response to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Now, maybe it was and maybe it wasn't, but we never even had the debate. I would argue we didn't have the debate because people simply assume in this country, in most cases, that military action is an appropriate way to deal with foreign policy problems. Now, we did, of course, have a debate over the Iraq War, but even in that case, I would argue that the debate was extremely militarized, and it was very easy for the administration for the first 2 years of the war to paint any opponent of military action as anti-American and anti-troop. So when we have a society as militarized as ours, people don't ask questions about foreign policy, and I would argue that's not helpful for the country, for the democracy, or for the military. I want to turn in my third and final points today to link the repeal struggle, the struggle to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, with the militarization of American culture. And I want to argue, following the work of a brilliant professor at Clark University, Cynthia Enloe, that the struggle to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and here I'm referring to the Palm Center at Santa Barbara, I'm referring to Nathaniel Frank's new book, Unfriendly Fire, I'm referring to Johnny Simons' wonderful and important new film, Ask Not, I'm referring to Service Members Legal Defense Network, that all of these efforts, as important and even heroic as they are, have had the unintended consequence of reinforcing and entrenching the militarization of American culture. So what do I mean, and what does that look like? Well, in order to make my point, I should tell you a little bit about what the repeal effort is. And I'll not go on at great length, but I'll just give one example. I was very proud 3 months ago when CNN, followed by the rest of the national media, reported that 104 retired generals and admirals are now calling for the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and are calling for open gay service. And I was very proud that the Palm Center contacted all 104 of those generals and admirals and rounded them up, got them to sign the statement, and went forward with this strategy. And we've done many similar maneuvers over the years. We were the first to report that the military was firing Arabic linguists for being gay. We were the first to report on the success that the British military had had integrating gays and lesbians. So these are the kind of strategies that the repeal effort is made up of. But one of the problems of all of our efforts is that we portray the military unproblematically as a glorified institution, and we portray poster boys, for lack of a better word, representatives of the gay community, usually blonde, usually white, usually male, usually strapping, who are supposed to represent the epitome of citizenship, the epitome of normativity, who reinforce the idea of soldiering as the archetypal moment of American citizenship. And questions are not raised about militarism more broadly. Now, one could argue that it doesn't really matter whether the gay community is militarized or not. After all, we're only 3 or 4% of the public. We're a tiny minority community. It doesn't really matter whether gay organizations like HRC or SLDN are militarized or not. I want to argue, however, that the gay movement has repeated a strategy that has been played out by almost every other minority community in this country. African-American groups made the same choice in the 40s and 50s. Women's groups made the same choice in the 60s and 70s. And that move is this. The military, as we know, has a history of exclusionary policies. Excluded groups, gays, African-Americans, women's, Asians, other communities, feel so strongly about getting access to the military in order to be included in the American vision of citizenship and included in the epitome of citizenship, that in order to gain the right to serve in the military, organizations representing minority communities step up to the plate and attest to the military's nobility, attest to all of the militarized ideas that I mentioned before, and one by one remove themselves from the pool of potential voices of opposition to militarism. And so what you have over 100 years is the sedimentation of group after group after group removing itself from the potential, from the pool of people who could ask questions about militarism, and you end up with a society where almost no one is asking questions about militarism. So, in conclusion, I want to argue that the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is inevitable. This policy shall pass. You cannot have a discriminatory policy that hurts the military, that is at odds with practices around the world. 25 militaries now allow gays to serve openly, the Philippines being the latest as of last week. None have reported problems. 81% of the public supports repeal. A majority of Republicans support repeal. A majority of churchgoers support repeal. 91% of young adults support repeal. Repeal is going to happen, and repeal is going to happen in part because of the strategies that all of the gay groups have used, and that's a good thing, and we should all be proud of that. But we also need to ask, at what cost? Thank you very much.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our topic tonight is Unfriendly Fire, a look at the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy by Dr. Aaron Belkin. I am Julian Chang, your moderator. And now it's time for a question and answers. Please forward your questions on the comment cards and to me, and we will ask Dr. Belkin these questions. Aaron, to follow up on what you were talking about, in a larger society, there seems to be a wider acceptance of GLBTs among the younger generation. Do you think this helps to make reversing or lifting the ban more likely?
Well, the important thing to say about American youth, in addition to the fact that 91% of young adults support repeal, is that there's a generational change going on in the military as well. Most of our military, of course, consists of young adult men and women who are not impervious to the MTV reality TV types of cultural influences, will and grace, that everyone else is influenced by. In 1993, when President Clinton tried to compel the Pentagon to allow gays to serve openly, only, I believe it was 18% of Army men were in favor of open gay service. And now the number is in the high 40s. But even more importantly, and this gets to the generational question, if you ask men and women in uniform, are you comfortable serving with gays? More than 70% say that they are comfortable serving with gays. And of the 20% who are uncomfortable, only 5% are very uncomfortable. So among young adults, there are very, very few people who are very uncomfortable around gays and lesbians, and that has a dramatic implication for the repeal initiative.
So to what extent is the Gay in the Military campaign also an effort to combat the homophobic notion that being gay is an effeminate expression of one's identity, for men at least, and does that affect any effort to speak out about the military's dominance in LGBT society or American society at large?
I would argue that the debate over Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been conducted in extremely disingenuous terms for 15 years, and that both sides care more about this issue because, as the questioner asks, about the civil rights implications and the implications for ideas about what's normal. That's what people care about, and less about military readiness. Now, what does that mean? It is absolutely true that integration will help the military. It is absolutely true that discrimination hurts the military. But that's not what the passion on both sides are about. The passion among the Christian right and people who oppose fairness is that they don't want the largest government institution to include gay people in the vision of American equality. They don't care about military readiness and military cohesion. This has always been about using law and using government policy to enact their ideas about who's normal and who's not, and who should be treated as a first-class citizen and who shouldn't. But let's be frank, for gay groups as well, the passion here is not about promoting unit cohesion, although, again, all the research shows integration will be good for the military. The point is, I wouldn't say promoting ideas about one type of good homosexual as opposed to another, but about promoting the idea that when the largest employer in the country proactively goes out of its way to fire people on the basis of who they are, that you're basically not a citizen of the country at that point.
Let's go back to 1993, and given the culture in society and the military in the 1990s, what would have been some viable alternative to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, if there was one? And was Don't Ask, Don't Tell, in your opinion, the best solution at the time?
No, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a terrible policy. It hurts the military. It encourages violence. It sends a homophobic signal to homophobic service members that they have open hunting season on gay and lesbian troops. It's a terrible policy. You could argue that it's worse than the previous policy, which was simply an outright ban. But I don't think there was an alternative in 1993 aside from open gay service. If President Clinton had played his cards properly, there's a pretty good chance that he could have simply gotten rid of the ban and moved the country to the place where we're going to arrive anyways, which is equality for everybody who can do the job, the Israeli system, the British system, the Canadian system. But he didn't play his cards right, and we ended up with a policy disaster.
So in the intervening years, your research has been extensive, and what has it shown as the consequence of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the case of gay men and lesbian women?
Are you talking about violence, or are you talking about
the impact of the ban? Has it been played out differently in different demographic groups?
Oh, I see. Different demographic groups experience the policy differently. So, for example, a disproportionate percentage of discharges are of women. And so there's a way in which Don't Ask, Don't Tell serves as a tool for misogynist service members who are not just anti-gay, but who have problems with women in the military. And there are many cases, as I mentioned in the prepared remarks, of women who have been sexually assaulted and who have not been able to report the abuse because doing so could have implicated their own sexual orientation. Well, that's not just a problem for lesbians. That's a problem for all women in the military. So 12,000 people have lost their jobs. Thousands of people have suffered, have left the military early, have died from suicide, have suffered from depression. But yes, there are differences across different subgroups.
Now, assume that the military is not making its recruitment targets, which is actually fact, and assume again that the draft somehow returns, or involuntary servitude, as some would call it. What is the consequence if this policy, the don't ask, don't tell policy, should stay in place if there's a draft and also an unpopular war?
Well, you can't have the draft and keep don't ask, don't tell in place in modern American culture, because if you do that, then men who don't want to be drafted are going to say that they're gay and they're going to kiss another man in front of the recruiter, and they're going to have to be excused from service, and the military will not be drafting very many people. Even Charlie Moskos, the late Charlie Moskos, the author of The Gay Ban, said that if there's a draft, then don't ask, don't tell should be eliminated because it's just not workable. But I don't think that the draft, the return of the draft, is going to be the. I don't think that's going to pave the way to repeal. I think congressional or presidential or judicial action will pave the way to repeal.
You alluded to the Israeli and the UK and the Canadian system. It seems like you've done extensive research on international militaries that have allowed open service. What generally has been the trend, and have there been any hiccups in the integration of gays into the militaries?
So I only know about 24 of the cases because the 25th is only a week or two old, the Philippines. But my colleagues and I have done extensive research into the situations in South Africa and Britain and Canada and Australia and Israel. We've interviewed over 100 experts on gays and lesbians in the military in those countries. We interviewed literally every person who had ever gone on record in those countries who we could find. So not a sample of experts, but the universe of experts. We interviewed Christian right groups and admirals and low-ranking service members and politicians and heads of NGOs. And we could not find a single person, not a single person, who could point to a single problem overall in any of the cases of open gay service. We heard again and again and again and again, even from people who predicted that the sky would fall, that the policy changed and it was a non-event. And if you watch Johnny Simons' film, Ask Not, you'll see British naval officers in uniform talking about how before the lifting of the ban, a survey was administered throughout the British Armed Forces, and about two-thirds of British service members said they would not work with gays and lesbians if the policy were repealed. The policy was then repealed, and two or three people resigned. So there has not been an overall problem with cohesion, readiness, morale, or recruitment in any military that has integrated gays and lesbians.
What about, have you studied any American combat troops that have served with openly gay people within their unit?
Yes, there are three or four ways in which you can study the situation with open gay service and American combat. One of the genius aspects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is that the policy renders itself difficult to study because everyone has to stay in the closet. You can't go administer surveys and to people with military cooperation. So how do you figure out what happens with gays and straights and American combat units? Well, first of all, as Julian was suggesting, you can look at integrated units in which straight American service members have served with openly gay foreigners in integrated units under the auspices of NATO or the United Nations or other multilateral contexts. We have studied such situations, and we have found that straight American service members are able to serve with and even take orders from openly gay foreigners. A second thing you can do is you can look at the history of wartime service in the United States, because it turns out that there is a very strange pattern that has characterized every single war going back to World War II, and I'm talking about Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War I, Gulf War II, that once the bullets start flying, gay discharges go down, because the Pentagon, of course, needs bodies in uniform. And so we have case after case after case of gay people who were in the administrative discharge process, a war starts, and they're deployed into the combat zone. And then they're fired after the end of hostilities. Now, if gays truly undermined unit cohesion, you would think that you would have problems emanating from those circumstances. There's never been a problem reported. A third thing you can do, and I'm very proud that the Palm Center just published a study to this effect, is you can do statistical analyses of the relationship between the outness of a unit and the quality of that unit. And we weren't able to get the military's help, but through ZOGBI, we were able to administer surveys to 545 troops who'd served in Afghanistan or Iraq. And we asked them, how many gays are in your unit who are known by everyone else in the unit? And then we asked about the quality of the unit, the cohesion, the readiness, the morale. And it turns out there's no relationship between the presence or absence of gays in a unit and the quality of that unit. So there is a great deal of evidence from the American military that open gay service is not detrimental to cohesion and readiness.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California entitled Unfriendly Fire, a look at the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy by Dr. Aaron Belkin. Aaron, can you describe, based on your experiences or observations, the impact of militarization on the individual psyches of gays and lesbians who decide to enlist and serve quietly under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy?
That's a very hard question, and there's no research on that question, of course. So all that can be done is to speculate anecdotally, but I think what I would say is that in 10 years working on this movement, working in this movement, I have only met one gay veteran who had raised questions about the military or as an organization or militarism in general. I think that the combined effect of being forced to live in the closet, of a highly militarized society, and of a gay community that doesn't understand military issues, is that most gay and lesbian service members are, and I don't want to appropriate people's voices, so I want to make this clear. This is just my speculative interpretation. But they're clinging for meaning because they're given such mixed messages. In other words, they're told that they don't belong anywhere by all of their different communities. And one thing that I've seen kind of seep into that space is a kind of valorization or perhaps an over-identification with the military.
We've talked a lot about militarism tonight, but let me play devil's advocate for
Please.
A minute. Can militarism play a productive, cohesive role in offering a greater tribal identity, especially in a society as diverse and divergent as the one in the U.S.?
I would say quite to the contrary, that one interesting phenomenon about militarization is the way that it lines up with normativity. In other words, ideas about what's normal and what's not, and that the effect of militarization is actually to squelch difference and not to celebrate difference, but to portray difference as unimportant or bad. And I would argue that that's the case sexually and racially and in terms of any other dimension of difference that you can think of. Masculinity, for example, in this country, to the extent that it lines up with militarism, articulates itself in terms of a very narrow model. I mean, what is the militarized model of masculinity? It's stoic, it's tough, it's dominant, it's unemotional. That's masculinity in a militarized sense. There's no space in a militarized model for other forms of masculinity. So when you talk about tribalism, I assume what you're talking about is celebration of minority and community differences within the broader American melting pot. I would argue that militarization is about erasing those differences, not celebrating them.
Well, actually, I think another way you could look at tribal identity would be that we all share a common platform from which to identify ourselves. And so in that case, it would be taking heterogeneity into a homogeneity model, so that people who come from different family backgrounds, incomes, origin of mother tongues at home, now all of a sudden have a common lexicon, they have a common way of dressing, they have a common way of looking, they identify each other throughout life as brothers and sisters, whereas before they would be on the surface seen as the other.
Sure, and you could argue that in a healthy democracy, there has to be a tension between diversity and assimilation, and to the extent that the military has played a formative role in assimilating different communities into a broader American model, that's an important contribution. I don't think the problem, at least according to the research on militarization, is that the military sometimes acts as an assimilation engine. In part, the problem is when people don't ask questions about military values and the military as an organization. The point of militarism is not that the military should never be celebrated. The point is that there are costs when it is only celebrated.
So from a public policy perspective, how do we begin to unmilitarize society? And do we even want to do that?
Well, so in terms of desirability, I guess the answer to the question of whether it would be helpful to demilitarize society, at least in part, depends on whether or not you think militarism is playing a productive role in society. If you think it's good for the military and good for society when citizens don't ask questions about military force, then we shouldn't worry about demilitarization. I'll give you an example. It is really not much of a stretch, at least in academic circles, which you could write off as communist if you'd like to, but it is not much of a stretch to claim that the United States has an empire. Now, it's not an empire that looks like the Roman Empire because we operate through surrogates, but we are forward deployed in more than 100 countries. We support financially and militarily governments throughout the world. That's pretty close to an empire. Now, you can say that's a good thing, you can say that's a bad thing, but in a militarized society such as ours, there is no conversation about empire. Did you hear a word uttered during the presidential campaign as to whether empire is beneficial for the United States or not? If you think that it might be important to at least ask questions about whether we should have an empire or not, are the costs of empire worth the benefits, for example, then I would argue, yes, demilitarization may be important. Now, how do you demilitarize society? It's pretty damn hard. And I would argue that a first thing that you need to do is you need research that starts to ask questions about whether there are costs of militarization and needs to ask questions about whether militarization is an important phenomenon in society. And I'm very proud that there's a new research initiative at Brown University about to launch the Eisenhower Research Project that's going to do just that. And I think that some activists on the left have been asking those questions for years, but those questions have not percolated into mainstream public discourse. So one important thing you need to do is to is to use research to ask questions about militarism. And a second thing you need to do, I think, is just as a citizen, notice where militarism is and isn't. It was shocking to me when I sat at the ROTC meeting at UC Santa Barbara to note the different ways in which ROTC was trying to militarize campus. But the other two professors who were part of that meeting were not troubled at all. And not only were they not troubled, I don't even think they were noticing the militarization of the meeting. So I guess the second important thing to do is to just be aware.
So, In your opinion, is there another nation that is as militarized as the U.S.?
Well, that would be a topic for research, but off the top of my head, I would say Israel is pretty close, probably the top of the list. Saudi Arabia is a highly militarized society. Iraq, before and after, is a highly militarized society. So sure, I mean, militarism can be pervasive in democracies and authoritarian states.
I think that would be really shocking to a lot of Americans to think that they live in as militarized society as Israel, or to think that they are living in as militarized society as Saudi Arabia, for instance.
Well, again, it depends how you conceive of militarism. If you conceive of militarism only in terms of tanks or percentage of military budget of GDP or size of the armed forces, no, we're not as militarized as China, for example. But if you conceive of militarization in terms of Hummers and air shows and children's coloring books that have fighter planes and things like that, then you start to see militarism in a lot of little corners in our society, kind of hidden in plain sight. For example, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal movement. Like, who would have thought of that as a militarized moment? I would argue it is actually quite a militarized moment.
I would agree. We are talking about Unfriendly Fire, which is the title of a new book by Dr. Nathaniel Franks, who works with you and for you at the UC Santa Barbara Palm Center. And in one of the classic defenses of keeping the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is sexual activity within the armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
And could you discuss, please, the issue of sexual activity, either hetero or homosexual relationships in the military, and should this be allowed if the ban is lifted?
So I published a study, actually in a good journal called International Security. It's edited at Harvard, and the study was on nudity in military showers. And so I like to introduce myself as a world. There are no illustrations, but I'd like to introduce myself as a world expert on nudity in military showers. And what I can tell you is this: it is extremely important to the military to act as if and regulate as if there is no sexual conduct in the armed forces. In fact, sexual conduct, gay and straight, is rife in the armed forces. It's rife in Iraq. It's rife in Afghanistan. It's rife at West Point. It's rife everywhere there are service members, because service members, like all other human beings, have sex. Now, you can imagine some people on the right make the claim that the sexual activity that pervades military life is the reason why there should not be women in the military, and it's the reason why gays and lesbians should not be allowed in the military. Here's the problem. All of the evidence shows that even if there were no gay people in the military, you would still have same-sex sex and same-sex eroticism in the armed forces conducted by people who don't identify as gay. And if you didn't have heterosexual sex in the military, and this has been a problem for military administrators for time immemorial, you would need to have a de facto military brothel system, or worse. And this is exactly what has happened in the American military throughout our history. And so while it's important for the military to pretend as if there's no sex, the bottom line is there is sex, and it's not the fault of gay service members or female service members. It's the fault of the human condition, and it's not going away no matter who you exclude from the armed forces. If you excluded every woman and every gay person, you'd still have just as much sex in uniform. Well, I don't know about in uniform, but among people who are service members.
In American jurisprudence, both in congressional acts of law and also in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the military is given great deference because it is an institution that is unto itself and sufficient unto its own are its rules. Should the military deference continue in light of our burgeoning understanding of human sexuality as a fluid expression of self-identity, or as the norms of society are changing, as you had alluded to, with the intergenerational differences.
Let's talk about military deference for a minute. So military deference, as you mentioned, is the notion that the courts should defer to the armed forces or to the Congress when it makes military personnel decisions on questions of constitutionality and should basically give the military either a free pass or set a lower standard for the constitutionality of military policies because judges are not competent enough or sophisticated enough or smart enough to make judgments about the constitutionality of proposed military policy. So several important things about the deference standard. First of all, people who are happy about the expansion of the deference standard act as if judicial deference to the military has characterized American jurisprudence for the last 225 years, plus or minus, in an even-handed way. That is absolutely untrue. And what the research shows is that the deference standard was greatly expanded under the Rehnquist Court. And the reason it was expanded under the Rehnquist Court is because conservative justices wanted to use the deference standard to allow the military to get away with constitutionally suspect policies, conservative policies, in other words, without scrutiny exercised by the court. Gays in the military is a classic example. You cannot make a legitimate First Amendment argument about the legitimacy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and keep a straight face, and yet, invoking the deference argument, courts have been, in general, unwilling to say that the policy violates the Constitution. So the first thing to note about the deference standard is that portraying it as a standard element of American jurisprudence is wrong. It is absolutely a social construct, and its expansion was heralded for blatantly political reasons. The second thing about the deference standard to note is that I hesitate to use this word, but it is ridiculous. And what is ridiculous about it is that in 21st century America, judges are making decisions, for example, about Genentech and genes and the scientific basis of patented molecules. They are making decisions that are so unbelievably complex that to claim that military matters are somehow so mystical and so, you know, so opaque that judges cannot make sense of them is to defy common sense. It really does not take a PhD in sociology to read the literature about homosexuality and unit cohesion. In fact, I would argue that it takes about a high school degree. So for judges to claim that deference is needed because they don't understand military matters is disingenuous at best.
Let's talk about the state of the law for a minute. The California Supreme Court last year now classifies being gay as in a suspect class,
yes,
same as being of a racial identity.
Yes.
Now, how will this, if any, affect the military's separations?
Well, so when we're talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we're talking about federal law, of course. And
right.
So state law, California Supreme Court opinions have no standing when we're talking about the constitutionality of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What I would say is that depending on how you read the Lawrence decision, you can make the argument that that the Lawrence court was saying, in effect, that gays and lesbians are now entitled to a higher level of scrutiny, a higher level of constitutional protections, if you will, than was the case in the past. Unfortunately, Lawrence has been read in different ways by different courts, and it's not at all clear that that reading of Lawrence will prevail. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Ask, Don't Tell may survive a Supreme Court challenge.
So Lawrence was based on conduct, obviously, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell obviously started off with conduct and now has moved to just the status of being gay now.
Not quite.
No?
No, go ahead, though.
Okay, well, maybe we should clarify that before we go on. I mean, has just the status of being gay or lesbian been sufficient now under the policy to get you separated from the military?
Okay. So in this country, it is constitutionally difficult to punish people for having an identity. We don't punish people for being a certain thing. We punish them for doing things, and that's good. That's an important element of freedom. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, for that reason, is desperate to portray itself as a regulation of conduct and not of identity. We punish people, according to the government, for homosexual conduct, not for simply being a homosexual. That's what government spokespersons say. And actually, there's a I love this. The Government Accountability Office, the GAO, did a report on gays in the military. They referred to Don't Ask, Don't Tell as the quote-unquote homosexual conduct policy 11 times on one page. So this is obviously a panicked utterance, and the reason it's panicked is because it seems unfair and it's also unconstitutional to punish people who they are for who they are. Now, what is, in fact, Don't Ask, Don't Tell doing? Janet Halley, professor at Harvard, I referenced her before, writes a brilliant book where she argues that status and conduct operate interchangeably in Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And what that means is that you can get fired for homosexual conduct, for having gay sex, but also simply for being gay, and that those two terms, status and conduct, operate as proxies for one another. So if military lawyers accuse you of doing the deed, and you say, ah, but I'm not gay, it doesn't matter because you're guilty of conduct. And if they accuse you of having the identity, ah, you're gay, and you say, oh, but I didn't do the deed, I didn't have gay sex, that doesn't matter either because you're punished for your identity. So status and conduct masquerade for each other in the administration of military justice. And the reason that this is a very dangerous policy is because if you amplify that standard to other laws, in other words, allow other people to be punished for their identities, but pretend that they're being punished for conduct, you have growing incursions into the Constitution. And these questions, of course, get raised in the Patriot Act, in racial profiling, and in other sites.
So in the context of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you could admit to your status or your sexuality, but still have your benefits ripped out from you, even if you are celibate in conduct.
Sure. Well, this is what's amazing.
Can I ask that question? First of all, I came in late. What is Don't Ask, Don't Tell? What does that mean?
We'll talk about that after the.
Because I asked the question and I'm trying to understand the answer.
I understand, but there's a protocol here. You can get fired for either status or conduct. But amazingly, and here's a further twist of hypocrisy, there is in federal law what's known as a queen for a day exception. This is actually part of congressional law right now. And what that means is that if you are caught having gay sex, but you can prove that it was an accident or emergency, in other words, that it was just a one-time occurrence, it's unlikely to recur, you were a quote-unquote queen for a day, then you don't get punished. And so that's what our law is. You're only punished for same-sex sex if you're gay.
Is there a difference between branches of the military treating gay people who are in the military and come out differently? So are sailors being treated more harshly for declaring their homosexuality than airmen or Marines, at complete total risk?
Okay. I would argue that the interesting difference is not service branch by service branch, but it's unit by unit. There are now about 65,000 gays and lesbians serving in uniform. About half of them are out to their peers, and about 600 are being fired every year for being gay. So do the math. The vast majority of people who are out to their peers are not fired. The administration of justice is capricious. It depends completely on the unit context, in other words, on the whether the climate in the unit is homophobic or not, and there are openly gay Marines who are not having problems, and there are perfectly closeted celibate office workers in the Army who are having problems. So it really differs unit by unit.
Representative Ellen Tauscher has introduced the Military Readiness Enhancement Act to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell as an act of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think are its chances of passage under the Obama administration?
Well, I think it's inevitable that the policy is going to be, the law will be repealed. Gays and lesbians will be allowed to serve openly. But it is fundamentally unknowable if repeal will take place a year from now or 10 years from now. You can make a very smart argument that 81% of the country favors open gay service. The Congress is controlled by Democrats. President Obama has stated clearly that he supports repeal. What's the problem? The policy will be gone in a year or two. That having been said, it will require an expenditure of political capital for the president because there are conservative Democrats in powerful positions, such as Ike Skelton, chairman of House Armed Services, who may try to be obstructionist. One thing that the Palm Center argues is that Obama, strangely enough, because this hasn't been discussed for the last 15 years, but Obama does have executive authority as commander-in-chief to issue an executive order suspending the gay discharge process. So even though the law would remain in place, he could order the military to stop firing gays and lesbians. We simply don't know what's going to happen.
Let's bring it full circle now. So let's assume that the policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed by an act of Congress. In your mind, would that make this country less militarized, or do we need to go through a type of soul-searching such as the Germans did with their historical experience before we become demilitarized? What, if anything, is the link between getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and becoming a demilitarized society?
Mindfulness. We have to do some soul searching, and just getting rid of the policy is not going to do the trick, in the same way that the integration of African Americans and women did not demilitarize the society.
Aaron, well, now we've come to our last question, and this is a rather personal question, but I will still ask it. So, what will you do if and when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is repealed?
Sleep.
Our thanks to our guest tonight, Dr. Aaron Belkin of the Palm Center from the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has been discussing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and the new book published under the auspices of the Palm Center is called Unfriendly Fire by Dr. Nathaniel Franks. Our thanks to you for being part of the Commonwealth program tonight. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.